Welcome to Project Chatter, the podcast where PPM experts from various sectors talk about the latest trends. Listen to Val and Dale as they talk about tried and tested best practices and share their unfiltered thoughts about the industry. Whether you're here to learn how to progress your career, improve your project control skills, or just want to hear an Aussie and South African rant about projects, then you've come to the right place. Welcome to the Project Chatter podcast with your hosts, Dale Fung and Val Matthews.
In this week's pod, we were joined by Georgia Stillwell to discuss how to create anti-fragile projects. Georgia, with over 10 years in construction and risk management, is a renowned expert in capital project risk. She has advised global industry leaders and shared her insights as a guest lecturer at UCL and the University of Auckland, focusing on risk management and ConTech.
A sought-after speaker, Georgia has featured at events like Built Worlds Paris and on Deloitte's Future Proof podcast. As a member of the Institute of Risk Management, she's dedicated to leveraging AI for project risk and schedule optimization. Currently, she leads as Head of Professional Services at Alice Technologies, EMEA, driving innovation in construction. So another big word, two podcasts in a row, Val and Martin, anti-fragile. It was fascinating to understand the context of anti-fragility within project delivery and some of the successes that have been used or have been found using certain technologies. But what were some of the key things that came out for you, Martin?
Yeah, I liked her example about where she implemented some of the things that she talked about, a project in Norway. She has some really interesting insights around the role of leadership in enabling anti-fragility on projects, because, you know, as we say most weeks, it's all almost about culture as well as technology. How about you, Val? What were your main takeaways?
Yeah, I think we put planners on the spot a bit. I think anyone who's a planner who's listening might find this a bit interesting, because critical path and the contention of whether it was useful or not came up, which I thought was always interesting. I love it when we challenge. But also how contracts and behaviors, you know, influence how projects are really delivered, and that, you know, regardless of the software you use, it's really down to people.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think the one-upping a really experienced planner will get those planners listening, and project directors and anyone involved in projects should have a listen. It might challenge their current thinking, as you say. But we'll leave it there, folks. You make your mind up. So as we say, keep listening, keep liking, and keep paying it forward.
Hello, project people. Welcome back to a brand new episode of the Project Chatter podcast. It's good to have you with us, and it's good to see Dale keeps himself busy with another podcast. I feel like he's cheating on me. I hear Gen AI podcast is going very well. Dale, how are you?
It's going very well, Val. I think that's because you failed to make an appearance out of the first 7 episodes. But yeah, you might want to listen to the last one, because we've given you quite a lot of stick. But I'm going well, thank you. Things are good. Things are busy. I'm really looking forward to this episode, to be honest, with this topic. But yeah, let's see where we go with it.
I like a bit of stick. I think your ratings will pick up. I'll be that special guest that comes in, you know, just gets those ratings up for you. But it's a great podcast. If anyone, slight plug, has not listened to Gen AI podcast with Alan Mosker, Greg Lawton, and the podcast duo here, do check it out. Martin Carriston, it's good to see you finally arrived.
It's there before you tonight. I don't know what you mean.
This is true.
Turning up for a podcast.
This is true. I'm actually impressed that I can see your whole face as well. I'm very impressed by this. So it's going to be a very exciting day. Let's bring our guest on. This is already fun. Georgia Stillwell, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. Now, it's good to have a few countries here. We've got France and the UK and Australia all on the same call. How good is technology? But Georgia, we'd love to get into people's stories. I think one of the favorite things I do when I listen back to this podcast, because this is also my favorite podcast because we have such wonderful guests, one of the things I like to do is just listen to their kind of how they got into it story, or the origin story, as Dale calls it. So we might start there, because that gives us time to think about how we address your questions and answers. And also, we get to hear about you, Georgia. So how did you get into the world of projects for us?
Yeah, so if I go way back, I'm from little old New Zealand, and I actually grew up on a farm. And what I found growing up was I was super isolated from everything, basically because of infrastructure. So you needed a car to get around. Otherwise, you know, opportunities, jobs, university, going to play netball with friends was really hard to do. So that led me into a fascination with kind of the bigger picture of master planning in cities. I went and studied urban and regional planning. And then I landed my first job, which just happened to be on New Zealand's biggest mega project, which is the City Rail Link, currently being built now. So I was a graduate there working as a planner. And in that role, I got exposed to the machine that is a mega project. I got to go on site visits, see my first TBM, and kind of begin to understand the political environment and kind of the world of projects. In that role, I worked with maybe 23 different subject matter experts, and we were all collating in information to get this project underway. And I first got exposed to project controls. So there were a few very influential people in that project. And they were like, come into project controls, you know, come to the dark side. You seem to like the numbers and tracking things. And they were giving me a little bit of exposure, which was great. Then, like many Kiwis and Aussies, I went over to the UK, and that's where I really cut my teeth in risk management. So I started working as a consultant in risk management in London. And I was working for a very boutique risk firm with some real kind of risk legends, let's call them. Like literally the director wrote the book of project risk analysis. And so it was a really fertile training ground for learning about risk and the real principles of it. And he was a master of the real detailed analytics. So forecasting and doing quantitative schedule and cost risk analysis. And I got to work on a great project there. So it was a redevelopment of Waterloo Station. If you've been to the UK, you've probably been through Waterloo. It's the most frequented station in the UK. And what was great about this project, another mega project, was the whole life cycle of the project was about 2 years. So the planning, the execution, the closeout was in this short time frame. And with mega projects, not a lot of people get to live through the whole life cycle because they're so mega. Whereas this was a really unique shot to do that. So I really love that. It was great exposure to how things work in the UK, to rail infrastructure again. And I also worked on an alliance, which if you want to get into contracts and details, was a very interesting thing to see, especially from a risk perspective, because maybe not all the parties in the alliance have the same appetite for risk or care about it at all. But we're all meant to be one alliance, holding hands, achieving things together. So that manifested in an interesting way. And yeah, after that, I jumped into a few more rail projects. So Crossrail 2, the sister project to Crossrail 1, which is now Thameslink. Now the Elizabeth line. And then I went on to Thameslink. Then I went to the dark side. So I know you guys love to talk about digital and AI, and I kind of fell into the world of construction technology. And so I joined NPLAN, which is startup risk forecasting company in the UK. And I just saw what they were doing, and I'm like, they're changing the game. I want to be a part of that. It makes a lot of sense. Because in my time as a consultant in London, even after 5 years, I kind of felt like I'm going from project to project. It's a bit of same, same, different project. Seeing the same issues. And even though I wasn't that experienced or, you know, some wise hat with gray hair, I started to see the repetition in what was very kind of standard business as usual approaches to projects, and thought, you know, I'm ready to be part of the change. So I jumped into software, never expected that, but it was awesome exposure to work across more sectors because I'd been very transport focused. And at a software company, you know, working across infrastructure, commercial, industrial projects in the UK and all over the world. But it was pretty tough, you know, translating what was pretty exceptional technology into a very ingrained industry. And it's like skiing uphill, or it's a little bit of suffering to be doing that as a daily basis. And yeah, now I do the same thing. So I work at Alice Technologies, set up their team in Europe because they're a Silicon Valley based startup optimizing projects. So specifically focusing on schedule and time to deliver them faster. And yeah, they were running out of the US, but they had projects in on the other side of the world. So I helped them set up their team in Europe, which I lead today. And yeah, using again AI and all these new tools to help improve the state of kind of business as usual project controls, project management. So yeah, that's how I got from a farm to Silicon Valley in a way.
That is amazing, Georgia. What a journey, and well done. It's certainly not the end of your journey, I'm sure, but so far you've had a lot of experience, a lot of varied experience, and I think, you know, certainly with the technology space, there's still a lot more that we can do in the project space. So keen to explore a bit more of that with you. I'm keen to know what an anti-fragile project is as well, because does it say what it is on the tin? This is a new word to me. Although I'm South African, so many words are new to me.
Yeah, so anti-fragile was kind of made famous by Nassim Taleb, who wrote The Black Swan and a lot of key kind of risk and uncertainty books, a real kind of legend of our time. And so anti-fragility, if you'd put it in a short sentence, is projects or things that thrive in systems which are uncertain or have a lot of risk exposure. So things that actually improve. They don't just suffer and wane. So the idea of an anti-fragile project is a project that can adapt to things as it changes and actually maybe improve its situation as the project goes on. So you are all more experienced than me. You've probably heard this, you know, the plan or the schedule goes out the door as soon as we start on site. You know, that was just a pipe dream, and like reality is kind of digging holes, concrete in an Excel spreadsheet. And I think a lot of that comes down to is these schedules that people make today, they are rigid. They're like a spaghetti of links, and it's so hard to keep it up to date and realistic. And if something major happens, it's kind of like, we'll just re-baseline it and chuck it out and do it again. It's not agile. It's not anti-fragile. It kind of, it breaks. And that's why you don't use it. You kind of throw it out and go like, this is just a mess. So to give you a scale, I would say like a fragile project is one that when something happens, a risk or some kind of event, it breaks. Like the end milestone is thrown out, the project's going to be delayed. And that's because it's got, you know, one critical path. And once that's blown, it's blown. Then there's this idea of a resilient project, which is one that can maybe withstand a few risks, because it's got some contingency, it's got some buffers and float in there, but it's still fragile. It has this maybe limited amount that's been put in, and maybe it'll work out, maybe it won't. Whereas an anti-fragile project is this idea that you only put in your hard constraints. So like I have to dig the hole and then I can put my drain in, but you don't put in your preferences. So you don't say I'm going to do drain one, then two, then three, and actually when you have a delay, then it will adapt to what of those preferences is best to start off with. So if you think of a project as like a decision tree, and every time you make a decision, you know, we start in area A, we do the foundations in area A, whatever, we do the walls in area A. Every time you pick area A, you lock out all the other options in the decision tree, which was going to B or C or whatever, and that becomes your plan. But in an anti-fragile world, you kind of have all that decision tree available to you the whole time. And when you hit a delay, you don't just shunt your project to the right like a traditional schedule risk analysis might. It will actually find new paths within, while keeping those hard constraints. So I don't know if that got the message across, but it kind of, it's flexible. It's really a project that's flexible, and it's what experienced project directors have to do anyway. They're kind of sweating, oh, based on my experience, we need to put more people on this job, or we need to order in another crane. They're kind of running these algorithms in their head, using their experience to kind of make a guess. And instead of making that, there are tools out there today that, you know, we can calculate that worth pretty quickly and find ways to recover. And that's this kind of concept of an anti-fragile project.
So, okay, that's awesome. So thank you for explaining it. It certainly made sense to me. Martin's nodding. I think Val's in agreement that he kind of understands and follows what you're saying. Before we get into the advantages and how to actually achieve an anti-fragile project, what are the root causes that make a current project fragile? Is it the way that we've been educated to plan projects and deliver them? Is it the way we've, the experience that's been handed down? Do you know why?
Yeah, so I think it goes back to the original or the OG Gantt chart, which, you know, you plan via your longest path or your critical path. And of course, there are other paths around it, but to make this one schedule, you're having to pick, you know, take a line on the decision tree and then plot it. Someone's probably smashing it into P6 or another software. And then you're like, this is the plan. So I think that's still very standard. It's the traditional way of planning since, you know, 1970, and it's still the standard today. Contracts even require this type of planning, even though people are very aware of the flaws with it or the amount of diligence you really need to make it really functional and excellent, which is, you know, near on impossible unless you're some legend scheduler, which you've had a few on the podcast. So I'm not saying it's completely unattainable, but it's, I would say for 95% of contractors or owners, it's pretty rough. So yeah, I think the standard way that we plan today with critical path method is it's a bit out of date.
Yeah, that's great. And thanks for explaining that. And you're right. I think, you know, the really experienced planners are like hen's teeth. And one of the conundrums I think we will have is that if technology takes away the planning skill, will we have anyone that actually understands how to plan and adapt and be responsive and reactive to when risks happen? So are you then saying that an anti-fragile project deals with risk better or removes risk?
I don't think there's any world where risk is removed. I actually hate when my partner says, there's no risk, you know, we'll be skiing off piece. He's like, there's no risk. And I'm like, there's no world with no risk. So removing risk, I think, is a pipe dream. But I personally believe it deals with it better. So risk today, I'm sure you guys are familiar with, it's like put a probability or some uncertainty, especially onto a schedule, and it just kind of, it shimmies to the side, shimmies to the right, and you're counting how many times it crosses that end milestone and giving a probability of it finishing on time. What's happening then is you're assuming when a risk happens, a transformer blows up, that the project is frozen in time, and then it's just going to pick up the original plan that it had. When I think that's no project I've worked on or touched, which is probably maybe over 100 now, has done that. You know, when something happens, again, the project director or the people around that person are thinking, okay, we could recover by changing up the sequence here, we could double down on this or that. They're trying to adapt to that new situation. And so I think current risk modeling falls short of that. And so an anti-fragile way is like you're keeping some of those decision tree paths open, and you only hold on to your hard constraints. So really like physical constraints, like I can have 20 people in this workspace, but it doesn't matter which 20, whether they're steel fixers or carpenters or whatnot. And that's where you can use an AI or software to explore what are those options to best like recover from the project. And I actually went a bit academic on this because somebody sent me a paper. It came out of UCL. It was like, what are the causes of poor mega project performance? And what they did is they scanned over 6,000 kind of articles and titles about poor performance of mega projects. And one of the key takeaways I took from this paper was people are obsessed with identifying and modeling risk, but actually when risk happens, people don't know how to deal with it. You know, it's really like relying on somebody expert in the project to like make a call. And often they don't make that call for a while because it's a really hard decision and it's hard to know, is it the best decision. So kind of I changed my tune from actually being more reactive to risk. And of course, with risk, we want to be proactive. You know, you want to put your smoke alarm in. But when the thing happens on site, how we react to it is why a lot of projects go bad, because the reaction is not the right reaction. And so that's where I've started to focus more and more of my attention on helping people make the decision or recover their projects. It's kind of what I'm getting more specialized in, and often in advising these kind of lead contractors and owners on, is recovery by just keeping their hard constraints and exploring the rest.
Yeah. They're great, Georgia. I love the idea that everyone's pushing against the, you know, the standard or traditional methods, but for some reason, every time people try, the pushback is real. And, you know, we've been in the business long enough to know a great idea when we see one. And I completely agree. Like, if you're planning out a total project with limited flexibility, which is kind of what critical path method does by default, it has to, because it's based on logic and rationalizing what relationships between each activities make sense. And mm-hmm. through that noise, somehow you get the longest path, right? Or the most viable path that's critical, right? And I think the challenge is a lot of the times that's not within the hands of the contractors or the guys that are building the program. It's within the hands of the client. So mm-hmm. my question is more about how do we educate clients on the different methodologies, and how will that change industry if no one wants to move?
Yeah. I mean, that could be said for pretty much any different way to managing projects, right? But I would challenge that only clients can make the move. We actually work, currently I work with a lot of contractors and clients, because they all have a sphere of influence that they can control, right? So within your contract, if it's a fixed price, you've got your scope. It's up to you how you deliver it, more or less, you know, within some confines. But I think the owners have perhaps more to gain from anti-fragile projects, because at the end of the day, they'll pay for the risk. The contractor will find a way for them to pay for the risk. And so I think if they're able to challenge contractors when they come back with a variation saying, oh, you know, owner, you gave me access to this part of site late. All my people are standing around. We can't start for 3 months. Owner can then say, actually, yes, you're right, that part of the site isn't available, but, you know, based on the work that you have and what's physically available, you could do this other work. Or at the same time, you can use in claims to challenge. So claims are always kind of this mystery of just shoehorning in everything that went wrong into one thing that actually went wrong. And it can be used with a bit more transparency. So this was delayed. Here was the impact. Here were all the options available to us, adding manpower, adding equipment, having people work Saturday, changing the sequence. And here's the most cost-effective one. And have that as an open dialogue, which maybe is a dream. But, you know, we've got to keep pushing in the right direction, even if not everyone wants to go there, because some people are open to it. And the more large and influential clients we have, you know, they start to push others around them into that sphere of influence, and we'll get there. It's definitely not an overnight thing for any construction tech or new approach, but you know, someone's got to do it.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I'm challenging just the status quo as well, because I think when we think about projects, a lot of the time as well, and maybe you've got an opinion on this one, that the real program doesn't start from project kickoff. It starts in the bid phase. And I've been, you know, not a victim, but I've experienced challenges from going from bid to project, because some marketing numpties decided to just slash the program to make it fit. Happens all the time. Cost, whatever the resource constraints, client influence, whatever contracts, whatever it is that is influencing the decision. But in reality, that's what happens. And then you're left with this dog's breakfast of a program that needs to be restitched, reorganized. Mm-hmm. And from day one, the project's probably already out of kilter. Does your proposition of this anti-fragile project, does it start, where does it start in the project lifecycle? Is it pre-project or is it something you do once you're on the ground?
Yeah. So you can use it in any phase. I guess in the earlier stages, what you'd be doing is exploring completely other options to deliver your work. You know, while, rather than the one plan you came up with, you could see potentially hundreds or thousands of ways to deliver your project and pick what is right for you, or pick the fastest and then be up against it. Pick something in the middle, depending on the risk appetite of, you know, whoever you're working for. In the actual delivery phase or closeout phase or even pre-construction, this is when you can start to react. So it's really strong in reacting to things that happen or change. And so the same way you inherit a schedule as the project delivery team from the bid team and go like, what is this? That's when you can start to figure out what are the other options, what variables of the project are worth dialing up and down and exploring. And then when you're in delivery and something does go awry, as it happens on every project, otherwise we wouldn't need project managers or anyone, we'd just, you know, go on the train tracks. Supporting that decision to make the most efficient or effective recovery would be really, really handy as well.
Yeah, I got, well, you've triggered my imagination now, which is usually a long conversation, but I'll keep it short. We'll get Martin in here. Wouldn't it be great if, you know, you had swim lanes of all the methodologies, including this one, or methods, let's call them methods, and you could run them in train and see what the comparative differences are between them, and then maybe overlay the risk profile. Because I hear what you're saying. I think if we only use hard constraints, though, to dictate the project, then aren't we pushing aside some of the benefits of critical path? So it may still be useful as a tool, but not necessarily throw it out. You know, I'm concerned because every time we hear a great idea, it's either this or that. It's a dichotomy situation. And I'm wondering, is there a way to bring them all together? You know, give peace a chance, Georgia. What do you think? This episode is sponsored by Deltek, your gateway to peak project performance and profitability.
Deltek's world-class PPM solutions offer robust cost control, customizable workflows, scalable scheduling, and advanced risk analysis.
Trusted globally by thousands, Deltek drives your project success to new heights. Discover more at deltek.com.
Yeah. I mean, you can keep some of your critical paths because of all these kind of scenarios you'd explore, each one of them then is a schedule with a critical path. So it's not like one or the other, but it's at the beginning having that flexibility on which one you're going to choose. And then you go like, yeah, this is great. This is what we want to optimize for. Let's go for this. So then you are on, you know, you have a traditional CPM schedule that's an output and you're following that until you hit the next bump. And then you go back to just sticking with your hard constraints and exploring the rest of the variables in the project. So, I mean, they can live together. They do live together. They live together for a lot of people I work with today. But if I zoom out to construction technology in general, because I think, you know, just not bogging down people with too much CPM and risk management chat, what I'm seeing, and you guys are probably seeing at the moment, is there's a lot of great construction technology out there at the moment, but none of them talk to each other. And there's kind of this human interface where it has to kind of extract all these Excel downloads and kind of put it into a Power BI dashboard. So that's one of the places I hope, you know, in 10 years from now, we'll be talking about it. Like we talk about dial-up internet now. It's like, oh, remember how clunky that was? And we'll be like, oh, it's so amazing now all of these great tools talk to each other. So it doesn't have to be one or the other. They're actually like apps on your phone, you know, you don't have one app for everything. You've got a bunch that help deliver the project and they kind of are integrated at some dream state and time.
Yeah. Now you've actually, I'm sure there's beads of sweat pooling on planners all around the world when you said no more CPM, because I said it's enough for them. A lot of these guys, you know, their career is literally based on this method. So if someone was to come along and say, we're not doing that anymore, it could be super destructive. But, you know, I'm an anarchist by nature. So let's get Martin in this, because I think Moonface Martin's got a lot of interesting dialogue and perspective. So Martin, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm quite interested in what you said. So you're saying you spend quite a lot of your time advising clients to really look at their hard constraints in order to recover or maintain their current programs. Do you have any real life examples where this has worked successfully? Because it seems, I don't know, just in my head, it seems like there is a risk, pardon the pun, or a danger that we may be hiding stuff just by potentially moving logic around or that. But have you got any examples where the kind of work you've done has really helped to maintain a program?
Yeah. So plenty. I just have to think of ones that are publicly available at the moment and protect our other clients' interests, especially we have a lot of clients using us in the bid phase now, which you can imagine is very competitive. So, yeah, we have a client. They're building a bridge in Norway, in like far reaches of Norway, the hinterlands. And at the very beginning, they had a plan. And then at the very beginning of the project, they're hit with this massive flood. I think it was 43 days. They couldn't start on site. And yes, it's an act of God, and they can claim against this in their contract. But still, they're like, how can we show the owner all the different ways we can recover? So we work with them, you know, pulling all the different levers on, is it, you know, one crew is just working Saturdays? Is it doubling down more crews? Do we need an extra barge? Do we just push the project out and face penalties? Of all of those options, you know, what is the best? So we ran through them, and it was like something like just having the concrete pouring crew working on Saturdays was all they needed to recover. As opposed to a lot of the initial ideas were, let's throw down another barge with another crane and another whole set of everything, which would have been one hard to get in remote Norway and really expensive. And kind of based on someone's gut feeling like, okay, we need more equipment to get this faster. So we can search with them that actually based on the constraints you have and the variables you can play with, the most efficient answer was just having one crew work overtime. And it was like, it seems like blissfully simple, but unless somebody's going through and crunching all those different scenarios in P6 and changing calendars of every crew and adding equipment, changing the sequence, it's really, you know, too much work to do to even figure out what would be the best. You just submit in a claim of whatever for, fingers crossed, something that you would hope recover the project.
Well, that's interesting. It seems like in that case you're really relying on the project team pulling together. So you're really relying on the skill of a planner to be able to give you that kind of proper what if scenario there. You're relying on the skill and the experience of the PM. And it's a little bit of a follow on to my next question around, in your experience, are you seeing businesses and projects being more or less willing to take on risks to their project, almost accept starting projects with a greater level of risk than maybe, say, 10, 15 years ago? And what is the role of technology, if any, in that potential change? And
yeah, I guess so. Just to reframe, it's like, are people taking on more or less risk because they feel confident they can maybe more effectively recover with tech? So I would say I'm not seeing people take on more risk. They're actually more wizened, I think, to risk, especially with the collapse of some major contractors in the UK within the last 5 years. And I mean, the profit margins are still so vulnerable for most contractors that, yeah, nobody's like, yeah, let's take on a bucket more risk. Tech will save the day. I think they're just open-minded to these tools to solve some of their existing issues. You know, they all have winning and losing projects, and they want to have less losing projects. It's like, just make the worst stuff better, and then we'll start making the good stuff better. You know, like, just to break even more often is, I think, a nice goal for a lot of contractors, or, you know, make 2-3% profit. I do think that tech can help with productivity and profitability in the sector. I'm like a strong believer in that. Otherwise, I wouldn't work in construction tech. And we are seeing a lot of impact in that space. So that keeps me motivated, despite all the skeptics, you know, you meet along the road. It's good to have some tangible results and people that really get it.
Definitely, yeah, that's a real benefit. And yeah, kind of linked to that, probably as a more general question, so, you know, some of the stuff that you talked about is quite advanced level risk management and theory. And one of the challenges that all risk managers, the three of us have probably experienced, the real challenge for them is explaining this data in a simplified, user-friendly, some would say dumbed down method. What are the kind of tips and tricks that you use to do that on your projects? Because using the example that you just had there, it sounds like you had a really mature team around you that were able to crunch that data and come up with these suggestions. Whereas, you know, not everyone is probably going to be at that advanced level. So what are the sort of tips and tricks that you use to really explain some of the concepts that we've talked about so far?
Yeah. Sorry if I've been dropping a lot of risk scheduling jargon.
Mate,
I have heard a bit of it on the podcast, so, you know.
No, we love it.
But you're right. I think any, not just risk, but any discipline that can't explain their logic approach in simple terms is gonna flop. And a lot of that comes down to the individual as opposed to the profession. It's like, how good are they at navigating that space? I always like to use analogies. I mean, for the anti-fragile project, you'll hear me talking about GPS software or navigation software. So, you know, when you use Google Maps, you put in your start and end. What it's doing is it's obeying your constraints, your hard constraints, start here, end here. And it's searching all the ways you can go. And it's suggesting the fastest one. It's optimizing for you. So the anti-fragile project is like that as well. Searching all the ways you could get to your endpoint based on the scope you have and the hard constraints. And then just like a navigation software, which normally when you go off-piste, you make a wrong turn. It doesn't just tell you to reverse. It re-optimizes from that point in time. So something's changed and it's not just saying go back. It's saying from your new point in time, what are the different options and which is the fastest, which is the whole anti-fragile concept is you've gone off the piste. Now, which lever of the project are you going to pull to still meet your end destination in a way? So I use analogies and I try to simplify things. I've worked at two kind of AI software companies now, and people have lots of different perceptions of what AI is and how complicated it is. Or some people are, you know, they've done some of their own extracurricular reading and they're there to challenge you on bits and pieces. I also just be frank, like I'm not an AI expert. So there's plenty of AI experts where I work at Alice, you know, with PhDs and whatnot. Can always put you in touch with them if you want to go into details. Also not to kind of fake the stuff that you don't know and just be like, yeah, a bit out of my remit. I can help you a bit and then go here. I think that honesty gives people the freedom to also admit what they don't know and what they're guessing about as well.
Yeah, that's great. And if I jump in there, Georgia, I think we had Dimitri Farmakis a few years ago. Mm-hmm. I don't think he's with Alice anymore. So you're not the first person on from Alice. So it's great to have someone back again. And we'll have more in the future as well, because this story will continue. I wanted to maybe throw in one or two provocative ones, because I was trying to listen through the lens of, you know, you said there's maybe a handful of really good planners that can do this stuff. So if I'm listening through their lens and they're listening to it, are they hearing that you're replicating what their abilities, so that we can spread more widely the ability to replan on the fly and be anti-fragile as we go? Is that what you say?
I think we can one-up them.
Okay.
Just in the speed. I mean, with Alice, it's an AI, right? So it's doing the crunching for you, whereas a human would be literally manually, I don't know, copy a project, make all the changes, hit F9, and, you know, we're doing thousands of iterations a second, and it's already auto-optimizing for whatever you want to optimize for, whether that is the fastest project or the most cost-effective or the least carbon. You can, like, choose what you point the optimization engine at. And that would be tough. That would be tough for a planner. And there'd be a lot of room for human error, especially on these schedules that are more than 10,000 activities. I think the tech can one up a planner. I think a planner could do that if they had unlimited time and they didn't sleep at night. But yeah, it's hard to compare, but they would definitely understand it, I think, and grasp the concepts, get how they can play with it and get the most out of it.
Okay, so are we saying we still need the human element with that experience plan, or we don't need it anymore? And then also, what do you say to, I guess, that skeptic project director or leader in organization that goes, prove it to me that it works?
Mm.
Yeah. So do we still need the human? It's yes. I think, I mean, you guys would have used ChatGPT or all the rest. Can be good for a starting point, but it's good to have a review and fix. I'm using a lot for my French translation, and even sometimes I pick up errors. So yeah, you definitely need a human. So one, someone that understands construction. Doesn't even have to be a planner. Like, we work with site engineers, project managers that can say the hard constraint is, you know, we build the substructure and then the superstructure. The technology doesn't know that by itself. You have to tell it the rules. Yep. And those rules are construction based, right? Then it's going to run all the simulations, going to try, and it's going to react. You still want to validate the output. I don't see anyone like blindly sending their project director like, here's what we're going to do to recover. They'll review that and go like, yeah, that is logical. Or no, I've missed something here. Or there's some political element, things that a computer maybe can't take into account. So it doesn't replace anyone's role. It just elevates it or makes it easier.
Okay, so we've got a tool that is much faster at processing outcomes than humans at a, I guess, a more accurate, what's the best way to put this, with more accuracy. And however, because of other various factors, we still need someone with the right experience to validate or select or make the decision on which course of action to take. Am I summarizing it correctly?
Yep, that's right.
Okay, so that's awesome, and that's good to hear. I mean, we love the fact that there's tech that we are able to use. I mean, the utopia, right? Isn't it cool if we would all stop working, and then just computers and AI does all the work for us, and we can spend more time with our loved ones and in nature and doing whatever else we want, maybe sipping a nice glass of wine. That would be fantastic. But I think the reality is that we've been wanting to go after this for, you know, many centuries now. We hoped that computers would give us a 4-day week. I think it's given us an 8-day week. So are we saying that this is going to increase productivity as well? Because that's one of the key questions for a lot of projects, is that can we deliver faster? Because if we're just saying that, you know, the risks that will happen regardless, and that we're just going to replan as we go, yet we know, even in reality, you don't down tools when you're replanning. No matter if the replan takes 3 months or 6 months, you still keep going at it. So is there any impact on productivity? What's the outcome?
Yeah, so I think it definitely helps people make decisions faster. And you're right. You know, if something blows up on site, people don't usually put tools down unless it's health and safety related. So it can definitely help make decisions, and then that can increase the productivity on site, right? So you might continue to work in one section of the site while you deal with this risk, but maybe you can open up other sections because you've explored these other options or whatnot, and you can just get to the conclusions faster. I know people are skeptical of, can we actually deliver faster and be more productive? We can. We can. There's so much space for it. And yeah, I'll challenge anyone that says we can't get better. And I know you've had people on the podcast before going, you know, we just, it's a pipe dream to think we can deliver projects faster. But I really.
Yeah, we're with you, Georgia. I mean, part of the reason why we have the podcast is because it's this open platform of discourse, right? We can agree, disagree, share ideas, be evangelists, be anti-tech, be for tech. And the listeners can make up their own minds of what actually works, what doesn't for them. I want to bring it back to the start of the conversation when we touched on commercial and contracts, because I think, you know, if we dance around how projects are really built, we all know that contracts have a massive influence on how we conduct ourselves. It's almost frustrating to think that we can go and talk about software making us more productive and have all these great tools that are available today, right? Not like in the utopian future, but today we could deploy all these types of different methods and software and make things a lot better. But we cannot seem to get away from contracts. So what's your view on this relationship of kind of anti-fragile and contracts? Because I know you've got an opinion because you're smiling right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, I mean, I have to agree with you that
what's your view, Georgia?
Dictate the behavior. They enforce it, contractually oblige people to behave. And it's hard because we're trying to, you know, a lot of these tools, they're helping people, you know, discover and deliver faster, but a lot of it is behavioral change, like choosing to adapt it and actually adapting it. But then if a contract says, you know, almost like behave this way to make money or it doesn't work, there is a conflict. So I don't actually have the perfect answer on this. I don't know how we can harmonize it. I just want contracts to, you know, at least have flexibility that people can even have them more simplified, you know, like just have, what is it fundamentally about, you know, the scope, the quality, the cost and the time, and give contractors a bit more freedom to deliver within that framework. It doesn't matter maybe how or what they do, as long as it's safe and whatnot, but they can use whatever tools they choose. Do they have to report the program back up in P6 format? Okay, whatever, you know, that can be dealt with. But I think it can work. But contracts, they do mess with behaviors, which it's always challenging. At the end of the day, everybody just wants to win, but these contracts, often someone wins at the expense of someone else, which is the least ideal one. So there's more collaborative contracting, you know, Project 13, alliance contracts. I'm all for that. But even having lived on an alliance project for 2 years, I know it's not perfect.
And if you read or you subscribe to, or you're a Bent believer, Bent Flivberg suggests that, you know, a lot of the project failures are subject to kind of people, and no, as a shocker, right? But it's around biases and those types of things. Leadership in particular. I mean, we've run some polls ourselves on, you know, why do you think, just qualitative kind of data on LinkedIn about what is the biggest contributor to project failure? And it's not methodology, systems, tools, contracts, process. It's leadership. It's people. It's our own embedded biases and errors. Can that be removed with software or this new anti-fragile approach? Because I would argue as well that I think that's actually one of the biggest elephants in the room, because we don't address behavior, and hence why contracts become apparent. Because if you think about a contract in your own personal life, it should only be used if things cannot be mediated, right?
I need to study psychology, because so much of my job is like, I'm telling them very rational things, you know, based with data and like rational numbers, and speaking to very rational types, you know, engineers, people that believe in this way of thinking, yet the behavior isn't rational. And it's so bizarre, and you're like, okay, really need to like understand how to manipulate and you know, work on the behavioral side of things. So can tools remove bias? It's a challenging one, because I think anything that is more data led, which a lot of tools are, help to reduce bias. But removing bias, I think, is impossible, because projects have people on them. Unless they're run completely by machines, there's going to be bias some in there one way or the other, whether it's someone at the bid phase, you know, trimming the budget and trimming the schedule, embedding a bit of optimism bias, that's it, into the bid so that you win. As long as we have people involved, we have bias. And tools that use large data sets, that data has probably been created by people and not collated by computers. Somewhere there's humans involved. So can anti-fragility remove bias? I would say no. Can it help reduce bias in decision-making by making a data-led decision? definitely can. But at the end of the day, someone is still going to make the decision.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think, and I know no one's got the answer. I mean, I'm sure there's smarter people out there than us that would suggest that there are ways to measure the effectiveness of decisions. And we've had this conversation with Dan Patterson and you know, another smart guy in the industry who knows what he's talking about, who says, you know, who actually speculated with us about potentially if we could, wouldn't it be great if we could somehow link decisions with the data that's presented and mark effectiveness as a form of recording progress and performance? Where are you on that? How, like, what's the boundary between kind of people and systems? Do we just kind of go full out, no privacy, or, you know, exclusive privacy? Or do we put the executives on the hook and say, your decisions are now part of the project reporting KPI for the client, and we're going to embed that in the contract, and you
must
provide
it? Well, that's definitely all project leaders and people have accountability, right, to their decisions.
Damn it.
So I am into, you know, matching up people's decisions with maybe the data presented. I think that's useful. How we could implement that robustly across all projects, I don't know, but I mean, people have to be accountable at the end of the day. And if the facts say one thing and they're presented with whatever facts or outcomes, and they choose something else, it's, they've got to have pretty solid rationale to step away. And some people do, and that's why they step away, and it's the right decision. But yeah, it's very irrational projects, even though, again, very rational types of people you tend to be working with, or typically rational, if I'm generalizing.
Yeah.
In your view, what do you think the role of leadership is in creating a culture of anti-fragility, as you call it, on projects? Like, what are the things that they can do to really set the tone? I have a follow-up question kind of semi-related to culture as well. And, you know, we talked about earlier about some of the implemented some of the mitigation actions, having done the reviews, and how kind of culture wise, how can we get construction workers to kind of knowingly follow some of the decisions that are made from using some of the technology, given, you know, they might have 30, 40 years experience, and, you know, it's probably going to be quite a challenge.
Yeah.
Listening to you.
So I think that's a good time for leadership actually to be more open-minded. And I don't think we see that a lot. We see them go to default or kind of courage when in uncertainty. And anti-fragility is about kind of thriving in uncertainty. So knowing, most project leaders know that, you know, the project's not going to go as perfectly as planned. Mind to new approaches and new tools, which I think it can be scary. It's challenging. Especially like things aren't going well, and then they start to say, I'm going to try this new thing. People are like, whoa, you've already steered the ship off the route needed. And then you ask about culture-wise, helping people make decisions with maybe some very experienced people. So I'm not that experienced. I think I'm experienced with my 10 years, but, you know, it's nothing compared to most people I'm speaking with and that I'm influencing or presenting results to. A lot more gray hair than me. So what I find is effective in making those decisions is, one, the storytelling, and also having some visuals. So with Alice, we do have a 3D part and like a completely un-3D part. And I just find the higher I go up the chain, the more kind of seeing how we'll deliver the project differently in 3D just makes people's minds up a lot faster. They can see it and they can believe it. Whereas if it's in a Gantt chart and they're getting like 50 pages of Gantt chart, it's like, you know, nobody likes that. I mean, maybe you guys like that. Do you like that, Dale? So I really think the visual can aid. I just see people make decisions so much faster with it. But not every project has a nice 3D model. And so it want to be flexible to those that don't as well. And I think that's where it's more storytelling. And I mean, at Alice, we work with project teams. So they make the results. They know more about the project than me or anyone on my team does. So it's more important that they have made it and they're telling this. That's, you know, the best way. Them internally discussing rather than an outsider or a consultant telling them, or a software, let alone a software telling them.
Outside consultant. George, are you trying to put us out of business? I mean, you're talking to three consultants right now, so That could be bad for our business. No, just joking. I don't care. One of the things I do have a question about, and just on that point, there is one visual that I think I can speak for all of us on the call that we do love, which is the performance measurement baseline, the PMB. But I won't get into that yet. One of the questions I do have, though, is if you're kind of working in the visual space, I actually think visuals is bang on. I think when you mentioned that, I was like, yes, that's 100%. I think the reason is because of translation, because projects are quite complex now. We've decided to make them bigger. And I actually think I miss the days when they were smaller. You know, I actually think one of the reasons we screw up so well on projects and it's so grandeur is because we compile these massive projects together. And if we didn't do that, I think we'd have a better chance at delivering the projects in front of us. And they try to do that.
And then, you know, look at the bigger picture, but never bite the whole thing off at once, because it's usually too much information for one human to comprehend. A computer, a model, sure, but a human, it's a lot to digest and it's a tough role. And it's also where, like, as myself as a leader, like, I can't be the expert in everything, and you've got to rely and trust people in your team to be the experts in their section of what they're working in, and to bring up the right pieces of information, escalate when needed.
Yeah, well, this is the this is the challenge, Georgia, is a lot of the times the executives don't know what they want, and if it's left to their devices, they may actually be sold on software could solve all problems. But we, you know, the guys that have been in the industry for a very long time, and I'd actually credit the co-host I have here, we came up with the kind of the 6-pack, 8-pack kind of rule, where you use the real estate collectively in smart ways. So you might have a partition that is relative to time, a partition that's relative to resources, a partition that's relative to cost, a partition that's relative to contract, a partition, if it's software related, relative to defects, whatever the flavor of the month might be, test and commissioning, maybe it's functional. So there are ways to slice a project up, particularly for executives. I think that's important. But also, you don't want to have any conflicting points on that chart or that 8-pack or whatever you want to call it, because we've also been, you know, brutally named and shamed when the data's wrong. How does software or this anti-fragility method that you're describing deal with error and recourse? You know, getting back on track, getting back on course, recovery actions, opportunity management. How does it do that? I just had an idea, Georgia, while you were talking about it. I think we should stop using driving net analogies on projects, and maybe we should pick up aviation analogies, because wouldn't it be good if we had a pilot, a co-pilot, a navigator, maybe not air hostesses. All right, I didn't think that through. But it would have been good to think of it a bit, you know, because planes are a lot safer than cars, you know, and I think what we're doing at the moment is we're crashing a lot of cars. I think we just need to kind of take a step back. And I think it's more related to organizational design and behavior, maybe, than actually methodologies and fragility. I think, you know, if I look out the window of a plane, I'm like, how the hell is this thing holding together, carrying 200 passengers in, you know, at 30,000 feet? That's an incredible feat, right? And then you think about our projects and you think, God, we can't even send an email without screwing it up, you know. Just food for thought. Anyway, that's all I've got.
I wonder what was in his two espressos this morning, Georgia. But I had a similar thought. But the problem with that, if I can challenge you, Val, on that analogy, is that projects can't be compared to aviation, because, yes, planes can take off, land, and fly themselves, but they're entirely then in that environment controlled by machines and computers. When human error comes into play, that's when there's human error. So until projects are entirely delivered by machines and computers, I don't think we'll get there.
That's when you land in the Hudson.
Perhaps. Yeah, exactly. That's where you land in the Hudson. So I think we will get there in the future. We're not there yet. But conversations like this, the things that the Alice's, the end plans, the nodes and links are doing, are getting us to that place. And so it's always fascinating listening to anyone in this space. So thank you, Georgia, for that. And I know we're running out a bit of time here, but so folks, there you have it. This is the end of this episode. But remember, if you liked what you heard, please do help us pay it forward and share a link to this episode on your favorite social media. Once again, a massive thank you to our guest, Georgia Stillwell. And thank you all for listening. Till next time, we say stay safe, be disruptive, and have fun doing it. From a full house, myself, Val, and Martin, it's bye for now.
Project Chatter supports and is a member of Zero Construct. Zero Construct is a new working group that wants to lower carbon construction. Not everyone will be aware, but construction contributes to around 12 to 15% of total carbon emissions.
This is a staggering amount, and we need to reduce it. We are a growing community of people that want to help make this change. Everyone is welcome, whether you're an engineer, contractor, or consultant. You just need to want to make a difference.
Our aim is to grow a network of experts so we can all learn from each other and make a positive impact in the places where we work. We'll do this by sharing knowledge and making it accessible in engaging ways.
To join us and find out more, please visit zeroconstruct.com and register as a member. Thank you, and we look forward to speaking with you soon.
For more information, blogs, or to support our charities, visit projectchatterpodcast.com. And if you would like to sponsor the podcast, get in touch via our website.
You can also leave us a voice message via our anchor page and let us know if there's something or someone specific that you would like on the podcast.
The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this podcast belong solely to the participating individuals and not necessarily to the individual's employer, organization, committee, or other group or individual. Additionally, any views or opinions are not intended to malign any religion, ethnic group, club, organization, company, or individual.